fast, let his ideals get the better of him. Chastened, he summoned Dick to plot the comeback. They trimmed their sails, tacked to the center, and won, again and again. The only victory Dick missed was the biggest, 1992. Though Morris did try to tell me that Clinton's comeback kick in New Hampshire was plotted with him over the phone. The world, according to Morris, wasn't complicated. Over their 17-year relationship, when Dick was by his side, Bill succeeded. When Bill pushed Dick away, disaster. I met Morris at a restaurant on May 17, 1995. I've been talking to Clinton constantly since the election, Morris said. No kidding. But my resentment was temporarily replaced by fascination. As Dick dictated to me what he'd been drilling into Clinton for months, he morphed into a political version of the autistic math genius played by Dustin Hoffman in the movie Rain Man. His voice gained speed, but lost all its tone, as if it were being generated by a transistor wired to the back of his throat. His index finger tapped furiously at a slim pocket computer that stored the polls he called his prayer book, weaving that data with bits of policy analysis, political science theory, and historical analogies from England, America, and France. Dick spun out an elaborate theory of the 1996 race, that Clinton would win in 1996 if he neutralized the Republicans and triangulated the Democrats. Neutralization required passing big chunks of the Republican agenda, a balanced budget, tax cuts, welfare reform, and end to affirmative action. This would relieve the frustrations that got Republicans elected in 1994 and allow Clinton to push them to the right on popular issues like gun control and a woman's right to choose. Triangulation demanded that Clinton abandon Democratic class warfare dogma, rise above his partisan roots, and inhabit the political center above and between the two parties, a concept Dick illustrated by joining his thumbs and forefingers into the sign of a triangle. Triangulation meant Clinton had to deliberately distance himself from his Democratic allies, use them as a foil, pick fights with them. Combine these two Morris tactics with a strong foreign policy, a reasonably healthy economy, and public advocacy of issues like school uniforms and curfews that would demonstrate Clinton's commitment to values, Dick said, and Clinton would win in 1996. Morris explained his theory in elaborate terms, but it boiled down to a relatively simple proposition. Steal the popular-sounding parts of the Republican platform, sign them into law, and you'll win. The fact that it would anger Democrats was not a drawback, but a bonus to Morris. The fact that it would contradict Clinton's past positions and professed beliefs was barely relevant. Dick made obligatory references to avoiding flip-flops, but his cardinal rule was to end up on the right side of a 60% issue. If 6 out of 10 Americans said they were for something, the president had to be for it, too. As our main course was cleared away, Dick got down to business. I'm glad we've had this opportunity to get together, Dick said. I want you to know where I'm coming from and what I'm thinking. The president's happy we're meeting, too. He wants us to work together. The sound of Dick reporting to me on Clinton's state of mind made me cringe. But I said we have to try, my first full sentence of the night. In a weak attempt to establish my own bona fides as a Clinton expert, I added, he hates open fights, hates being presented with personal confrontation. But I wasn't worried only about the president's psychological comfort. The whole White House had become dysfunctional. Faced with an aggressive Republican Congress, we were floundering, unable to formulate a coherent response to their ambitious agenda. The day shift, led by Leon, would push the president toward a confrontational stance. We had studied Harry Truman's 1948 campaign against the do-nothing Republican Congress and hoped that Clinton would follow that fighting example. But that wasn't the president's style or Dick's strategy. On the night shift, Morris would pull Clinton back. Every presidential event, each radio address, had become a battleground. One draft would be prepared by the staff. A second would whir through the president's private fax. Clinton would take a little from column A, a little from column B, depending on the day, his mood, and whom he had talked to last. As Newt Gingrich was orchestrating House passage of the Contract with America, we were responding with a symphony of mixed signals. By the fall of 1995, my mercurial relationship with Hillary was going well. Her Woodward fury had passed, and I'd helped myself by how I handled the complex affirmative action debate. Although Hillary was instrumental in bringing Morris back, she also sensed the need for a liberal counterweight to him inside the White House. so several times a week, she'd call to check in on me and buck me up, often as she exercised. "How we doing today, George?" she'd ask, as her measured breathing and the hum of the treadmill served as background for my morning updates. If she called in the afternoon, I might be on the Stairmaster in room 11 of the OEOB. The phone by the machine would signal me with its distinctive ding-dong chime, and trying not to break stride, I'd give her my take on the budget and get hers, tell her what Democrats were saying on the Hill, pass on an interesting story on the television news. She no longer watched the news. It was too infuriating, too painful. But on one late September day, she called to console me on my latest bout of bad headlines and revealed how she was coping with her own. A few nights earlier, I'd been arrested in Georgetown. The charge was hit and run. The truth was I couldn't maneuver my car out of a tight parking spot on M Street. When I scraped the bumper ahead of me, an excitable police officer who happened by recognized me and made a scene, patting me down as a crowd gathered round. More bad luck. I'd carelessly let my license expire. The cop cuffed my hands behind my back and called in four cars to take me to the station. Although my car never left the curb, I was citing for leaving the scene of an accident. Several hours later, I was released with an apology from the station chief, and the charges were dropped. But the damage was done. Video footage of my arrest was all over the morning news. Later that day, Hillary called to talk. "I'm glad to see you've overcome your problems with the police, George," Hillary laughed. "You know, I've been thinking about what happened to you, and herself. Both of us got plenty of ink for things we didn't do, like throw a lamp at her husband. Both of us made even better copy when we really did screw up, like when I threw a temper tantrum at a Treasury official. Hillary and I bonded again. Two liberals, two lightning rods, Boy George and St. Hillary, commiserating about the press and our other shared enemies, musing about how being caricatured drives you crazy and the futility of trying to fight it. Whimsical and bitter, wistful and shrewd, Hillary signed off with praise for how I left the station house, head held high, a calm smile on my face. "That's what I've learned how to do," she explained. "Whenever I go out and fight, I get vilified. So I've just learned to smile and take it. I go out there and say, 'Please, please, kick me again, insult me some more.' You have to be much craftier behind the scenes, but just smile." In the fall, Dick Morris had come up with a formula to produce a budget deal with the Republicans. Morris had discovered Medicare, and he was now planning to force the Republicans to compromise by launching a multi-million-dollar ad campaign showing the president standing up to their assault on Medicare. For Dick, this was a twofer. Not only did he believe that the ads would improve Clinton's poll numbers and help pave the way for his prize budget deal, but his consulting contract with Clinton also guaranteed him a healthy commission for every dollar we spent on television. Despite Dick's support, I was all for the ads. The insurance industry's Harry and Louise campaign had demolished us during the healthcare fight. This time we'd beat them to the punch. And Medicare was our best weapon. The only Democratic issue as potent as the Republicans' less government, lower taxes mantra. All year long, the Republican leadership had threatened to stop funding the government and financing its debt if the president refused to sign their budget. "We want to force change," Gingrich warned Clinton in a meeting before the August recess. Now the showdown was only weeks away. To prevail, we'd have to convince the public that the president was making a principled stand against blackmail and using his power to protect average people. An ad campaign focused on Medicare would help Clinton and the congressional Democrats sustain a presidential veto and survive a government shutdown. Morris didn't want a Clinton veto. He insisted that the ads, coupled with back-channel negotiations with his former client, Trent Lott, the number two Republican in the Senate, would produce a budget deal long before it came to a veto. Dick asked me to help with these secret talks, just as I had worked with him when we were constructing our June budget. "Only Lott, Gingrich, Clinton, Gore, and Panetta know about it," he told me. "Lott and I will be the negotiators. Gingrich specifically requested that you and Ickes be kept out of the loop, but I need your help with the deal." Dick also asked me not to discuss our conversations with Leon Panetta, who complained that Morris was a spy in our midst. "Okay," I lied. Since Morris was a Republican mole inside our White House, I would be a double agent. Dick would relay his conversations with Lott, and I would report back to Leon and Pat Griffin. Not that I really needed to. The fact that Morris and Lott were talking was the worst-kept secret on Capitol Hill. Lott was giving detailed debriefings on their conversations to the entire Republican leadership, which would filter back to us through Pat's network of Hill contacts. In turn, I tried to sensitize Morris to what Democrats were thinking, and to help him understand the political realities behind the budget numbers that he and Lott were throwing around. For example, I explained that meeting Lott's bottom lines of a $200 billion tax cut and a 7-year balanced budget under the economic assumptions of the Congressional Budget Office would require almost $500 billion more in cuts than our June budget. No Democrat would vote for that, I told Dick. The president would be perceived as caving, and he wouldn't be protecting Medicare as we were promising in our ads. Morris listened, but didn't hear. The truth is, he didn't really care. His theory demanded a deal, so he had to get one. But he feared that once the Republicans walked the plank and actually voted for a final budget that included deep Medicare cuts, a subsequent Clinton veto would harden each side's position and make compromise impossible. That was fine with me. I was happy to take the issues to the 1996 election, and even lose, rather than have Clinton sign anything close to the Republican budget into law. I didn't think a good deal was possible. The gap between the two sides was too big, and the consequences of the Republican cuts, particularly on the poorest children and seniors who relied on Medicaid as well as Medicare, were too devastating to contemplate. A Democratic president just couldn't sign them into law. Even if a decent deal were possible in theory, I believe that Clinton couldn't forge it without the sledgehammer of a veto, and his party would lynch him if he tried. If you force Clinton to make a deal before he has the veto, I argued to Dick, you're forcing him to commit political suicide. What the president would do was anyone's guess. He was talking tough in public, but itching for a deal. The Morris theory merged in his mind with his natural inclination toward conciliation, and a Panglossian faith in his ability to achieve what he willed. To nudge the process along, he supplemented the Morris Lott back channel with his own quiet phone calls to Speaker Gingrich. We worried about these contacts, fearing that the Republicans would be smart enough to make some quick concessions and lock Clinton into an agreement that wouldn't get Democratic support. But the Republican leaders were hemmed in by hubris and their own restless troops. The freshmen elected in the Revolution of 1994, who equated compromise with capitulation. They overplayed their hand and, like me sometimes, underestimated the president. Unlike Morris, Clinton understood the implications of the budget numbers, especially in programs like Medicaid that he administered as a governor. I know a bit about this, he'd say. Poor kids are going to get screwed. That's what I feel passionately about. While Clinton was willing to give the Republicans a balanced budget with tax cuts, he refused to accept what he called their below-the-line goal, an end to activist government, especially in health care and education. We're going through Stockman's revenge, he said at a September budget meeting, referring to Reagan budget director David Stockman's insight that even if supply-side economics didn't balance the budget, the deficits created by their tax cuts would create persistent resistance to all government spending. They're using the deficit to destroy government, Clinton said. To me, this observation was a sign that we hardliners had the president's other late-night advisor on our side. Stockman's revenge was a phrase I'd often heard Hillary use, and the fact that Clinton repeated it after a morning at home was surely no coincidence. Although Hillary was less visible now, devoting large blocks of time to handwriting revisions of her book, It Takes a Village, she was still the most powerful liberal in the White House. The combative side of her that hampered the healthcare effort and backfired on Whitewater in 1994 was exactly what we needed in the budget showdown of 1995. By late fall, force, diplomacy, treachery, and luck were complementing each other in a manner Machiavelli would have appreciated. Our hard public line, coupled with our advertising campaign, was unifying Democrats and weakening the Republican position. Simultaneously, Dick's secret talks with Lott, Clinton's soothing phone calls to Gingrich, his distancing from Democratic allies and premature public concessions, all sincere in their own way, combined to create an inadvertently ingenious disinformation campaign. It lulled the Republicans into believing Clinton would cave if only they waited long enough. But the Republicans didn't know that towards the end of October, the confrontation camp had a new asset. As Morris became more prominent, he started to get more press scrutiny. The Sunday Times ran a front-page story detailing how, in his previous work, Morris had openly and forcefully ridiculed Mr. Clinton's personal conduct and policy stands, and advised his clients about how to seize on the president's vulnerabilities in their own campaigns. Other reporters started to comb through Dick's record and discovered that he'd worked in Republican campaigns that had been roundly criticized for their racist overtones. Morris had bragged, for example, that he'd been behind the infamous White Hands ad for Jesse Helms, in which Helms's black opponent, Harvey Gantt, was accused of supporting quotas for racial minorities. For another Southern Republican candidate, Morris had developed a radio ad that defended the symbols of the old Confederacy to the tune of Dixie. The public exposure weakened Morris. With the debt limit and government shutdown deadlines only days away, Panetta, Pat Griffin, and I took the opportunity to confront Dick in a meeting around Leon's conference table. "The next time something happens, these Democrats are going to go after you," Pat told Dick. "The price for a vote is going to be your head." Now the black male was working for our side. Terrified at the prospect that he would be triangulated, Dick experienced a political deathbed conversion. "I have now reassessed everything," he said. "It's becoming clear to me that we cannot compromise now, that we cannot reach a deal. I'm not even sure we need to balance the budget anymore. People believe that we wanted to balance the budget, so we don't have to do it. But the only way this strategy of intransigence can work is if we go heavily, heavily, heavily into paid media." Of course, going heavily into paid media meant millions more in commissions for Morris. Pat and I started kicking each other under the table to keep from laughing at Dick's transparent performance, but Morris kept right on talking. "Some people need a shot of vodka for courage," he said. "The president needs paid media. I need paid media. I have no courage without it." It wouldn't last long, but at a crucial moment, for the right price, Morris was a liberal like me. We were standing shoulder to shoulder, shaking our fists, saying, "No, no, no, we're going to veto." Morris would get his money. We'd prevail in the budget shutdown. I thought it was a small price to pay. Clinton was still a true believer in the original Morris doctrine of accommodation, an inclination reinforced by the increasingly likely prospect that the United States was about to go bankrupt. The Republicans were refusing to extend the government's credit line unless we made unilateral concessions on the budget. Treasury Secretary Rubin was using creative financing to forestall the day of reckoning. But if Congress didn't grant the government authority to issue more bonds, the United States was weeks away from defaulting on its debt for the first time in history, on Clinton's watch. Publicly, the president was resolute. Privately, he was wavering. "I'm not comfortable being this hard line," he said. Not only might he bear the blame when 43 million Americans failed to get their Social Security checks, but the president was understandably afraid that default could trigger a free fall in global financial markets. "It might," replied Bob Rubin, but in keeping with his Sphinx-like demeanor, he declined to predict the consequences, simply repeating his mantra that default was unthinkable. But so was capitulation. Steeled by years of weighing probabilities and placing billion-dollar bets in the bond market, the Treasury Secretary believed that buckling to a congressional blackmail threat would set a terrible precedent, weaken the presidency, and eliminate our leverage in the budget talks. His resolve was consistently our best counter to Clinton's vacillating tendencies. But during the two government shutdowns that occurred in November and December, the Republican leaders themselves were our secret weapon. As much as I would love to think that we were the sole authors of our success, their self-inflicted wounds and tactical blunders made the crucial difference. First, they failed to pass their budget on time. Although continuing resolutions, legislation designed to keep the government running while Congress completed its normal budget process, had become standard operating procedure over the last decade, the fact that the Republicans missed their deadline made it marginally easier for us to blame them for the government shutdown. Even more damaging was their decision to attach a politically poisonous Medicare premium increase to the legislation. Hitting that one back was like batting practice. Not only did their maneuver amplify the message of our television ads, which had been recut with fresh footage of Gingrich praising the day when Medicare would, quote, wither on the vine, and Dole bragging about being one of 12 senators to vote against Johnson's original Medicare proposal, it also proved our blackmail point. Clinton vetoed the continuing resolution, effectively shutting down the government. But when he appeared before the cameras to scold the deeply irresponsible Republican leaders for cutting Medicare as a condition of keeping the government open, the president was the picture of stern compassion, America's dad. Gingrich, meanwhile, looked more like America's brat. At a November 15th breakfast, he had told a room full of reporters that he sent the tougher bill to the White House because of how he'd been treated by the president on the trip to Prime Minister Rabin's funeral. "You land at Andrews Air Force Base," he complained, "and you've been on the plane for 25 hours, and nobody has talked to you, and they ask you to get off the plane by the back ramp. It's petty, but I think it's human." An hour after Newt's breakfast, my phone was ringing off the hook. By noon, the White House photographer had found a picture of Clinton and Gingrich conferring in the Air Force One conference room, a photo we helpfully released to our friends in the media. By nightfall, the Beltway was buzzing about the speaker's temper tantrum. The next morning, the rest of the country would be too. Democrats displayed the front page of the New York Daily News, a cartoon of Newt in diapers under the headline "Crybaby" on the floor of the House. Despite these gaffes, the Republicans were still in a strong position. On Sunday, November 19th, 6 days into the first government shutdown, the White House was functioning with a skeletal staff and our coalition was cracking. It looked like conservative Democrats might defect and vote with Republicans to override the president's veto. To ward off that disaster, our budget team drove to the Capitol with an offer to meet the Republican demand for a balanced budget in 7 years, if and only if they agreed to provide adequate funding for the president's priorities, Medicare, Medicaid, education, and the environment. In our minds, the two halves of the resolution canceled each other out. Nothing would be agreed to until everything was agreed to. Certain that the Republicans would reject it, we returned to the White House and waited. The president was puttering through the Oval Office suite in his sweatsuit. He stopped by my desk for an update. Gene Sperling joined us, then Panetta, and a few others. So we migrated back to the Oval to plan our response to the inevitable override. Clinton was grumpy. The rest of us were grim. Until Betty Curry cracked the door and handed Leon the Republican counterproposal fresh from the fax machine. Reading over Leon's shoulder, I saw that the only changes were cosmetic, replacing "if and only if" with "and," along with language praising veterans and citing the need for a strong national defense. "This is it," Panetta exclaimed. "Yes," I screamed in his ear. The president high-fived the whole room. Our fellow Democrats back on the Hill immediately agreed to accept the amendments, and the government was back in business. We Democrats emerged from the first shutdown more unified, while the Republicans grew more fractious. Whether the cause was hubris, naivete, or a failure of nerve, the Republicans had blown their best chance to splinter our party. From that point on, everything started breaking our way. The new agreement gave the Republicans time to pass their overall budget, which Clinton promptly vetoed with the same pen LBJ used to sign Medicare. Then, while Panetta led our negotiating team to the Hill to see if a deal was now possible, the president floated above the fray. He signed the Bosnian Peace Accords in Paris and was greeted like a conquering hero in Belfast. Back home, knowing that a second government shutdown was possible on December 15th, we devoted hours to keeping the Democrats unified and developing a consensus budget we could all stand behind if the negotiations with the Republicans eventually broke down. The days of triangulation were long gone. Feeling neglected, Morris left for a long Christmas vacation. While the president still preferred a bipartisan deal, he was getting more comfortable with confrontation. He allowed Leon to hold a hard line in the Capitol Hill talks, which was driving the Republicans rabid. Speaker Gingrich also understood that the calendar was working in our favor now, knowing full well that if there was another government shutdown, he'd be blamed, the Gingrich who stole Christmas. But by now, he'd lost control of his troops. They refused to reopen the government unless we agreed to their terms, and the second shutdown began. The freshmen had become Newt's Frankenstein monster, and my new best friends. The more they dug in, the better off we were. Even pragmatic veterans adopted their kamikaze spirit. "We will never, never, never give up," thundered Louisiana's Bob Livingston on the House floor. "We'll stay here until doomsday." On New Year's Eve, the budget talks at the White House recessed for the holiday. there would be no budget deal. But the president was still in a good mood. He was about to make his annual pilgrimage to Renaissance Weekend with some of the highest poll numbers of his presidency. Before he left, he called me into the Oval. "You should know," he said, handing me a piece of paper, "that Dick's blaming this on you. Confrontation is the key to Clinton's popularity. Advisor Morris's strategy proves inconsistent." The paper Clinton had handed me was a clip from the December 24th Washington Post, a story I'd already seen and savored several times, because it concluded that the only time Clinton's ratings have improved substantially the past year has been when he adopted a strategy of confrontation, not triangulation. Without saying anything, the president watched me reread the entire article. I couldn't help myself. Every sentence was sweet vindication. The year that began for me in exile was ending in victory. We'd done the right thing, it was paying off, and now I was getting credit for it. Or was I? He's awfully quiet. He can't really be mad about this, can he? No, Clinton was just being Clinton. For months he'd been playing me off against Morris, taking the best from both of us and turning it into something better. Dick had been right to push the president to propose a balanced budget. My White House colleagues and I were right to insist on a firm defense of New Deal and Great Society commitments that Morris would have sacrificed in a second. Clinton was right to pick and choose, creating a synthesis that was good for him and good for the country. But in this quiet encounter at the close of the year, Clinton must have sensed how maddening it was to be subject to his manipulation, and he was making up for it with the perfect gesture at the perfect moment. "Don't worry," he smiled. "Dick's a little paranoid. Just keep on doing what you're doing." "I don't want to stay." The words escaped my mouth before I realized what they meant. But Dr. Hyde's smile showed he understood. Around my age, with the short hair and bulky build of a rugby player, he was a specialist at the top of his field, neurology and psychiatry. And he had just explained that if I didn't learn to manage the stress, I wouldn't make it through a second term. When I blurted out that all I wanted was to get through the next year and get out, he applied some gentle pressure. "Can you really walk away from the White House? Don't you feel an obligation to stay?" But his questions didn't make me feel ungrateful for being unhappy or guilty for wanting to go. That's how I knew it was time. Of course, the decision wouldn't necessarily be mine. It was only 1995, a dark afternoon in mid-December on the brink of the second government shutdown. We still didn't know how that confrontation and the 1996 campaign would conclude, and I was determined to leave on my own terms, after we had prevailed on the budget, after Clinton had become the first Democratic president since Roosevelt to get elected twice. So I bargained with the doctor. "Patch me up now, and I'll promise to change my life later." He prescribed Zoloft, a medication for anxiety and depression, and ordered me to take more walks. I'd been putting off this visit for months. I'd been consulting a therapist since Vince Foster's suicide in 1993 and experienced a long depression in 1994. Now my nerves were shot, and it had started to show. During the June 1995 battles on the budget and affirmative action, hives erupted across my chin. I grew a beard. The rash subsided after an August vacation, but my most pernicious symptom persisted unseen. It was a sound, a fingernail screeching across slate, or the tines of a fork scraping a bone china plate. Several times a day, for up to an hour straight, it would loop around my brain and reverberate through my torso like feedback from an overamplified guitar. By December, I couldn't take it anymore. I needed quiet now. So when Clinton flew overseas, I finally drove myself to a nondescript high-rise off Wisconsin Avenue, where I sat on the edge of the sofa as Dr. Hyde told me what I already knew. I was burned out. A serotonin reuptake inhibitor like Zoloft, he then explained, would help stop my nerves from flooding my brain with the chemical fueling my compulsive symptoms. Just hearing the mechanics calmed me down, and the medication helped even more. Soon I slept 4 hours straight. Then I was up to 6. I no longer woke up waiting for the sound to start. The feedback cleared, and I could breathe deeply again. Testing myself, I would see fingernails on a blackboard, hear the soundtrack, then switch it off. All of the White House stresses were still there, but they didn't affect me so severely. The medication stripped away layers of worry, allowing me to remember what it was like to be me, a melancholy nail-biter, sure, but not someone consumed by anxiety, not someone who measured himself by his proximity to a president or convinced himself that his words and deeds would make or break a presidency. It helped restore my sense of perspective, the internal balance my father had taught me to prize. I still worked hard, but worried less. I cared about what we could do, but didn't obsess. Calmer, more detached, I prepared to leave. Even as my health improved, I wasn't tempted by the thought of a second term. Of course, I still wanted Clinton to win. Victory would redeem our failures and validate our successes. 4 more years in the White House would mean more Democratic judges on the federal bench, perhaps another seat on the Supreme Court. It would mean that more of our people would be managing the government for more time, making the day-to-day decisions that add up to meaningful change. Legislatively, Clinton would use his veto to prevent the Gingrich Congress from doing too much harm, and his bully pulpit to persuade them to do some good. As commander-in-chief, he'd be more confident. As chief diplomat, more creative. Attuned by experience to the power of the office, freed from the burden of another election, he would become a better president. But not a bolder one. In 1993, Clinton groused that the bond market was turning him into an Eisenhower Republican. By 1996, with the nation prosperous and at peace, with Republicans controlling the Congress, it seemed that Clinton's second term would be even more like Ike's, and he didn't seem to mind. I couldn't fully blame him for bending with the times. The voters did send us a message, and moderation did have its virtues, but it wasn't all that inspiring. So like my boss, I would play it safe. While serving in the White House, I had survived failure, scandal, and internal exile. The next time I made a mistake or came under attack, I might not escape. Protective of my reputation, less enthralled by Clinton now, I wouldn't press my luck in a second term that promised to be competent but complacent, a second term encapsulated in a slogan, "The era of big government is over." A product of Dick Morris's word processor, that phrase was the heart of the 1996 State of the Union. The country loved it. Not just the death of big government, the whole presentation, with Clinton's patently passionate delivery of issues designed to appeal to suburban moms, school uniforms and curfews, stopping big tobacco from targeting kids, V-chips to block televised sex and violence. Ironically, though all involved government intervention, the proposals were wildly popular, which was at least half the point. Of course, I was no virgin. Taking a poll to me was like taking our temperature, and I had advocated the relatively inconsequential middle-class tax cut in 1992, not only because it symbolized whose side we were on, but also because it scored well. But during the Morris era, it seemed more and more like we were polling first, proposing later. My only original contribution to the State of the Union was a little dig at our most likely opponent. On the afternoon of the speech, as Clinton practiced before a group of us from a mock podium in the family theater, I interrupted when he reached the section on national security challenges. As drafted, it opened with thanks to our veterans for providing America with 50 years of prosperity and security. I suggested that the president stop there and single out Senator Dole and his World War II colleagues for special praise. Clinton smiled and made a note on his reading copy. The maneuver would rankle the Dole campaign, but what could they say? How could they possibly criticize the president of the United States for taking the unprecedented step of praising his prime opponent during the State of the Union address? Because it was a body blow wrapped in a bouquet. Clinton's seemingly gracious salute was a subtle reminder that Senator Dole's time had passed, and he was already in a deep hole. With the economy humming and Clinton stealing the political center, even a flawless Republican campaign would probably fall short. The crucial contrasts were working in our favor. 35 years of congressional experience tagged Dole as a Washington insider. Clinton was still a relative newcomer who seemed to be in touch with average Americans. The government shutdown, during which Dole repeatedly appeared in press conferences and our television advertising, joined at the hip with Newt Gingrich, portrayed him captive to the most extreme forces in his party, while Clinton showed his backbone by standing up to them. Clinton started green, but was growing into the job. Dole seemed too old to be president. Dole secured the nomination, but he couldn't develop any real momentum. When he tried to use his position as majority leader to pass popular tax cuts and force a Clinton veto, Democrats pinned him down on the Senate floor with amendments on our issues, like raising the minimum wage. Then he tried to reignite his run by resigning from the Senate. Although Dole's farewell speech was the most moving rhetoric of the campaign, its political benefits didn't linger. On the campaign trail, he looked lost, almost sad, a man homesick for Capitol Hill. Following our 1992 example, he tried to compensate for his lack of campaign funds by hitting the free media talk show circuit. But Dole's ironic humor didn't always translate well in television, nor did his clipped legislative shorthand, honed over 35 years of cutting Senate deals. In the emblematic moment of the pre-convention season, Dole argued with Katie Couric of the Today Show about whether tobacco was addictive. Taking on America's sweetheart, he seemed crotchety and out of touch. All we had to do was watch. But I still worried. Dole couldn't match Clinton as a communicator, but there was still the issue of character. The contrast between the straight-talking war hero of sterling integrity and the slippery draft dodger under an ethical cloud. Our internal mantra was public values trumps private character, a refined version of the formula that had worked ever since Jennifer Flowers and the draft. For us, it was now an article of faith that Clinton could overcome personal attacks as long as he kept addressing the real problems of real people. On the last day of the Democratic convention, Dick Morris was forced out of the campaign by a sex scandal. And for a minute, I felt sorry for him. I didn't like Dick. Hell, I hated him. I wanted him gone. But to face such a public disgrace on a day of such personal triumph seemed too cruel, too unusual, too Greek. No one should have to endure such a mythic turn of fate, even if it was his own fault. The feeling faded over the course of the day. As I learned the details of what Dick had done, not just hiring a prostitute, but letting her listen in on his phone calls with the president, I became more angry at him for putting Clinton and our work at risk. But at Hillary's insistence, I tried not to show it. Fearing that Dick was troubled enough to commit suicide, she had issued strict instructions for all of us to avoid any public comment that might set Morris off. When I arrived at the president's suite for the speech prep, he was already at the dining room table, scribbling on the draft spread before him. Concentrating on his speech, Clinton didn't mention Morris. Maybe it was my imagination, but he seemed relieved, almost lighthearted. On top again, he didn't need Dick now. The win would be his alone. We worked through the day as if Morris had never existed, and I had a hint of what I would feel in our first residence meeting after Dick's departure. It was all so simple. Panetta took Dick's chair and gave a perfunctory 30-second now-that-Dick-is-gone speech. That was that. I was there. Dick wasn't. I had won. But man, I thought, this is one cold-blooded business we're in. 2 months later, 2 nights before Clinton's final presidential debate, a group of us were in the bar of the Albuquerque Holiday Inn, reviewing the day's prep session over burgers and beer. Around midnight, an advance man found me to say the president was on the phone. "You doing anything?" he asked. "No. Can you come up for a minute?" The encounter I'd been dreading. That morning, the New Yorker magazine had published David Remnick's profile of me, in which I openly discussed moving on before the start of the second term. Now Clinton was calling me on it. When I entered his suite, he was sprawled on the bed in t-shirt and jeans, with the contents of his saddlebag briefcase, folders, briefing books, a couple of paperback mysteries, and a new hardcover by Gary Hart spilled on the bedspread around him. "Do you really want to leave?" he asked. "Nobody around here can do what you do." I had steeled myself for just this moment. Clinton's personal magnetism had less power over me now. Watching it work on others still gave me a kind of clinical thrill, but I like to think that I had become more a student of his seductive powers than its subject. He foiled that defense by by tapping into my need to feel indispensable and saying exactly the right thing. Nobody around here can do what you do. Then there was the fact that he was president. Early in our term, though I was still captured by Clinton's charisma, I didn't have sufficient in-your-bones awe for the presidency itself, perhaps in part because we had beat an incumbent. Over time, as I developed a more realistic view of Clinton the man, my respect for the office increased even more. My apprehension that night was that I wouldn't be able to say no to a president. But I was also grateful to Clinton for the chances he had given me and the things he had taught me, for his intelligence and fortitude, for his commitment to public service, for coming through on the biggest issues and becoming a better president every day. And I was grateful that night because he didn't pull rank. After I told him about being treated for burnout, he suggested that I take a 6-month sabbatical, then come back to work. Thoughtful, but that's not how the White House works. The conversation drifted. After 90 minutes, I reminded Clinton that he needed to sleep and prepared to leave, relieved. The President of the United States had told me he needed me, but hadn't commanded my service, all I could have hoped for. On my way out, Clinton asked me to reconsider his offer. "Of course," I said. But both of us knew that this was goodbye. Election Day 1996, I slept in. Around noon, I threw on some jeans and a baseball cap for an anonymous walk around Little Rock. I wanted lunch at Doe's and to wander down Main Street to see the War Room. The space had been rented out for a corporate reception, recreated down to the headset for my phone and the little white sign Carville hung on the wall. Change versus more of the same. Later that night, in the presidential suite of the Excelsior Hotel, Hillary was in the back bedroom, helping Chelsea get dressed. Just before I left for a victory lap with the network anchors, I knocked on her door. She peeked out, just a minute, then came into the hall. Only the two of us were there, separated by a wall from the suite where the returns were being announced and Clinton was holding court. This was our private goodbye. She gave me a hug, then held me at arm's length for an extra second, a hand on each of my shoulders, her eyes shining. We smiled through the silence. Victory was vindication, even sweeter for her than her husband. She'd paid a higher price, taken harder hits, achieved fewer dreams. Now she'd have a second chance, and I wished her luck. She did the same for me. All the stresses and threats, all the suspicions and resentments, all the times the two of us had clashed because I blamed her for being too rigid and she blamed me for not being as tough as Kennedy's men, all that was behind us now. We had survived. We had won. All would be well. I love you, George Stephanopoulos. I love you, too. Staff no more. I walked out the door. Epilogue. On my own. Grateful for the privilege of serving a president, relieved to be leaving in one piece, I left the White House at the end of 1996, feeling as lucky as I did the day it all began. I would miss being on the inside, miss making decisions and trying to make a difference, miss the events that made history, and the intimate moments when the White House felt like home. But I wouldn't miss carrying everything inside, and I wouldn't miss being an assistant. For the first time in my professional life, I wanted to be on my own. I moved to New York for a new career as a writer, teacher, and television commentator, and slowly adjusted to speaking publicly without first calculating Clinton's position or how it would play. Liberated from the crisis cycles of the White House, I learned how to better balance my life. Over time, I stopped taking antidepressant medication. But habit dies hard. After a presidential press conference, I'd leave a congratulatory message with Betty Curry, hoping Clinton would call. When I defended him publicly, Clinton would return the favor by tracking me down. That was enough. 20 minutes of that familiar sleepy hoarseness, talking through the issues streaming through his mind. For the length of a phone call, I could pretend to be a president's man. That was how my story was supposed to end. But on Wednesday, January 21st, 1998, it seemed to start all over again. Shortly before 5 a.m., I prepared to check out of the Tutwiler Hotel in Birmingham, Alabama. The night before, I had given a talk at the university that included my usual riff on the Clinton scandals. By the end of 1998, I confidently predicted, the president will win the Paula Jones case, and Ken Starr will close shop without finding any wrongdoing by the Clintons on Whitewater, Travelgate, or Filegate. Now I was rushing home to teach my weekly class on the presidency at Columbia. But when I reached the front desk, the clerk handed me a phone. My new employers at ABC News were on the line. A big story was breaking with allegations about the president and a former White House intern named Monica Lewinsky. They had sex. Clinton might have told her to lie. There were tapes. Starr was investigating. In the cab to ABC's Birmingham affiliate, I fixed on the Washington Post story they had faxed to me. Clinton accused of urging aide to lie. Then I forged through the story for exculpatory facts, logical leaps, and questionable assertions. But the telltale signs were all bad. Attorney General Reno had personally authorized Starr's request to investigate allegations of suborning perjury, false statements, and obstruction of justice involving the president. There must be some hard evidence. Clinton's lawyer, Robert Bennett, denied a relationship between Lewinsky and Clinton, but wouldn't comment on whether the two had talked about her testimony in the Jones case. There must have been some conversations between them. Lewinsky's attorney, William Ginsburg, strangely refused to deny that his client had a sexual relationship with Clinton. Shit, they must have had sex. And there are tapes. Hours of them, describing the affair in graphic detail, including some conversations where Lewinsky recounted Clinton and Vernon Jordan directing her to testify falsely in the Paula Jones case. I borrowed the driver's cell phone to call the White House. But my successor, Rahm Emanuel, said he didn't know anything beyond what he'd read in the paper, and he sounded sick. His shaky voice brought me back to the worst moments of my old life, the afternoon in Little Rock when I heard Clinton on the Jennifer tapes, the night in New York when I learned about his draft notice, the morning in Washington when I read that Clinton had called his Arkansas troopers to keep them quiet. Blindsided again, and these were the most serious allegations yet. They were about the present, not the past. He was president. She was an intern. If Clinton asked her to lie under oath, or lied under oath himself, he broke the law. Although I still found it almost impossible to imagine how a president of the United States could take such a risk, my gut told me the core of the story was true. As much as I wanted to believe Clinton, I didn't, and couldn't pretend that I did. As much as I owed him, I didn't believe that loyalty demanded lying, and I had a duty in my new life to give honest opinions. As much as I still liked the president and supported his work, I was livid. How could he be so stupid, so reckless, so selfish? I reached the studio just as Good Morning America was going on the air. While the technicians fiddled with my microphone and earpiece, I reminded myself to stay balanced, to control both my anger at Clinton and my instinct to spin for him. Don't accuse, don't defend, analyze. When anchor Lisa McCree questioned me, I said that I didn't know much about Monica or her relationship with Clinton, then added my assessment of the situation. These are probably the most serious allegations yet leveled against the president, I said. If they're true, they're not only politically damaging, but it could lead to impeachment proceedings. But they're just questions right now, and that's why I think we do all have to take a deep breath before we go too far here. I didn't think I had gone too far. Saying that proven charges of perjury, witness tampering, and obstruction of justice by the President of the United States could cause Congress to begin the impeachment process seemed to me like an understatement. To the rest of the political world, it was a leading indicator. Hearing a former close advisor to the president use the I word, however qualified, made them think, even apologists like George think Clinton's lying this time. The political newsletter hotline made it the quote of the day. Worse, the Wall Street Journal editorial page cited me approvingly after years of snide attacks. Although my analysis was accurate, I hadn't realized when I said it that a single word would signal such a fundamental break with my past. On the second night of the scandal, during a primetime special on the crisis in the White House, Peter Jennings asked me what I would do if I were still in the White House. George, my assumption is that President Clinton has a lot better things to do at the moment than be watching ABC television. But if he were watching you at the moment, what would you tell him? I'd tell him, Mr. President, Get your story together. Get it out as quickly as you can. You've been through tough things before. You can weather this storm if you go out and get your story together and answer all the questions to the best of your ability. I wanted to scream, tell the truth, take responsibility. But get your story together was as far as I could go without directly accusing Clinton of lying. Coming clean with the country wouldn't be easy, but it was the right thing to do. The president was getting similar advice from my friends inside, from his friend and chief of staff, Erskine Bowles, from former chief of staff, Leon Panetta, from former deputy chief of staff, Harold Ickes. But at his moment of maximum peril, the president chose to follow the pattern of his past. He called Dick Morris. Dick took a poll. The poll said lie. Was out of Clinton's hands. By Monday, January 26th, I watched the president wagging his finger in the Roosevelt room with a kind of fascinated disgust. This was Clinton at his cold-blooded worst. Gone were the guilty tics of his past denials. The downcast eyes, the stutter, the dry throat and pale face that displayed a sense of shame and sorrow and vulnerability. Now, full of self-righteous fury, he was lying with true conviction. All that mattered was his survival. Everyone else had to fall in line. His staff, his cabinet, the country, even his wife. I don't think Hillary knew about Monica until Clinton came home from the Jones deposition. But Clinton probably didn't come clean then either. I imagine he told Hillary that he slipped up but didn't stray, that he befriended a troubled girlfriend of Betty Curry's, but it got a little out of hand because the girl was insecure, infatuated, and slightly crazy. She came on to him, began to imagine an affair. How could Hillary buy that? How could she not? The alternative was too painful to admit, and not only because she cared about their political survival. Every marriage is a mystery, but it seemed to me that their bond had been strengthened by the intensity of their White House experience, that Hillary had fallen in love all over again with the boy from Arkansas who had become the president she dreamed he could be. Hillary had to believe him. It was harder this time, but she had to. She had to believe that as he grew in office, he outgrew his past. She had to believe that he wouldn't risk their life's work for a fling with an intern only a few years older than their daughter. She had to believe that he loved her enough not to humiliate her. She had to do what she'd always done before, swallow her doubts, stand by her man, and savage his enemies. On the Today Show the morning of the State of the Union, Hillary sounded the trumpets for one more battle against the right-wing conspiracy. But I wasn't there to answer the call. I refused to vouch for Clinton's credibility, and I couldn't buy the party line that this was more about Clinton's accusers than his own actions, which meant I was the enemy now. That's the way it was with the Clintons. You're either for them or against them. I heard that as far as Clinton was concerned, I was now a non-person. My name was not to be mentioned in his presence. As the White House settled into a strategy of stonewall and denial, the rift widened. My commentary became more pointed, my tone more raw. They responded in kind, and my friendships became strained. A series of articles appeared in several prominent publications where I was featured as a poster boy of betrayal. Now I knew what it felt like to be on the other side of the White House spin machine. But my bouts of doubt were balanced off by all the leaking details. Monica's 37 White House visits, the late-night phone calls and gifts, the blue dress. So I steeled myself to the public criticism and became accustomed to reading hate mail from liberal Democrats instead of conservative Republicans. What bothered me more was what I heard from my friends. Carville and I still talk several times a day, but after one This Week performance, where I looked and sounded more like a prosecutor than an analyst, he screamed at me. "Boy, you were tough this morning. It feels like you're pulling for the other side." Paul Begala said I was acting like a father umpiring Little League, who makes all the close calls against his own kid's team. The truth hurts. There were times when I did start to pull for the other side. Although I wasn't proud of the feeling and tried to control it, I wanted to be right and wanted Clinton to pay a price. The longer he lied, the more it seemed like he might get away with it, the more furious I became. I was angry at Clinton for selfishly risking his presidency on a foolish dalliance and arrogantly trying to fix it himself, for lying about it and sending others out to lie for him, for paralyzing his policy agenda and making his accusers look like prophets instead of fools. The new covenant heart of Clintonism now seemed hollow. Apparently, the rule of personal responsibility applied to every American except the president himself. My heart was getting hard, partly from self-righteousness, partly as a shield against sadness and shame. I realized that the intensity of my anger was both irrational and uncharitable, but I couldn't help it. I took Clinton's actions personally. For several years, I had served as his character witness. Now I felt like a dupe. I had done everything I could to make Bill Clinton president, and everything in my power to keep him there. Although I wasn't proud of everything I'd done, I was proud of our accomplishments. The scandal now cast a shadow over the whole endeavor, making it seem more like an experience to be explained instead of an adventure to be celebrated. Decisions I had defended in the past seemed more dishonorable now. The ultimate rationale for getting my hands dirty and doing what it took to win, from attacking Jennifer Flowers to working with Dick Morris to accepting welfare reform, was not just the thrill of the fight or my need to be on top, but also my belief that progressive ideals would be better protected as long as Clinton was president. If that were true, as I believed it was, then Clinton didn't have a right to put his presidency at risk. He didn't have a right to betray those of us who put our trust in him. He didn't have a right to compromise my compromises, to make me question whether helping him get elected was the best thing I ever did or the worst. All of these emotions boiled over on August 17th, when Clinton addressed the nation after his grand jury appearance. For many who had chosen to believe him, this was the worst moment. Now they had to start coping with feelings of anger, disillusion, and betrayal. For Clinton, it was another missed opportunity. If he had acted against type, if he had apologized, acknowledged his wrongdoing, and accepted responsibility more forthrightly, if he had resisted the temptation to vent his rage against Starr in that forum on that night, the impeachment process would not have developed momentum. For me, it was a relief. Clinton's admission, however grudging and cramped, ended the futile debates about what he did and whether he deserved to be believed. It helped me put his failings back in perspective. As angry as I was, I didn't believe that Clinton should be removed from office. In all of American history, through countless scandals, petty and grand, only one president had resigned. Only one president had been impeached. Despite being saturated with all the tawdry details, the country still wanted Clinton to stay. Resignation may have been an act of personal honor, but the abusive conduct of Clinton's prosecutors and their cabal of partisan accomplices was an argument for resistance on behalf of the institution of the presidency. Starr's investigation demonstrated that Clinton lied under oath about his sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky, but it did not prove that he obstructed justice. Although Clinton humiliated himself, dishonored his presidency, and deserved to be punished, he did not abuse presidential power in a way that justified impeachment. His crimes were more about the man than the office. On September 21, 1998, my heart caught up with my head. The videotape of Clinton's grand jury testimony was about to be played to the whole country, and I was watching from a small room at ABC, where I would broadcast my commentary on Clinton's testimony. The tape started to roll. And even before the questions began, it had the quality of an amateur porn flick. The fixed camera angle gave the room a generic look. The lighting was bright and unforgiving. The ambient noise and off-screen conversations made me feel like I was eavesdropping on a private encounter caught by a hidden taping device. Most unnerving was the close-up of Clinton, the picture of a president of the United States alone and unprotected. No American flag, no presidential seal, no Oval Office desk. Just a man in a straight-back chair, facing a grand jury of his peers and the prosecutors who had ruined his life. The picture screamed, "No president is above the law." When the questions quickly turned to sex, and Clinton began to read his public admission, I felt a tug inside. Maybe it came from seeing his reading glasses again, the old-fashioned half-bifocals that we always encouraged Clinton to wear for photographs because they gave him a fatherly air. Now they just made him seem tired and old. For the first time in months, I began to sympathize with my former boss. After reading his statement, Clinton removed his glasses and waited for the questions to resume. For a silent moment, he was not on. not trying to charm, persuade, evade, or empathize, not relying on the ambivalent skills that had propelled him through a lifetime of political triumphs, but also landed him in that room on that day. He was a man alone with his failings before the whole world, a man forced to confess sins that had devastated his family and undone the hopes of his life, a man ashamed. He sighed. His face fell, the last breath from an all but deflated balloon. Off camera, I quietly started to cry. Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States. Clinton followed the sergeant-at-arms into the House chamber shortly after 9 p.m. on January 19, 1999, just like he always did, soaking up the applause, grabbing a few hands on each side of the aisle, impatiently eyeing the podium that held his State of the Union address. The speech was sure to be a winner. It always was. But as Clinton bounded toward the speaker's chair and patted the air with his hands to quiet the crowd, he seemed nervous to me, and who could blame him? A month earlier, in that same chamber, he had become the first elected president in American history to be impeached. Acting with a recklessness that matched Clinton's, the Republican majority in the House had passed two impeachment articles on a near party-line vote, and they were paying a price. A year into the Monica scandal, their poll numbers were in the tank, while Clinton's were higher than ever. Two Republican speakers had resigned. Clinton was still standing. He might never be able to erase the stain of impeachment, but neither would they. In Clinton's Senate trial earlier that day, White House counsel Charles Ruff made a powerful opening argument for acquittal. Tonight, the president was mounting the podium in his own defense. My fellow Americans, I stand before you to report that the state of our union is strong. Never mentioning the issue that had consumed his presidency, but armed with an arsenal of popular proposals on everything from Social Security to health care to education to crime, Clinton made his own best case, doing what he did best. Halfway through, he even started toying with his Republican tormentors. When they clapped, he praised them for getting into the bipartisan spirit. When they sat on their hands through a surefire applause line, he shot them a competitor's glare, a look that said, "You guys can pound me all you want. Tonight you're mine." When he basked in the reflected heroism of Rosa Parks, smiling from the balcony, he seemed like a man without a care in the world. Sitting across town, in what had become my usual chair at ABC, I had to laugh, delighting in the sheer virtuosity of Clinton's performance. Even the "I love you" he mouthed to Hillary as if the whole world wouldn't notice. "This is our moment," Clinton said, as he drew to a close. And he was right. America was doing fine. Better than fine. Better than I ever could have imagined that morning 6 years ago, when I handed him his inaugural address minutes before he took the oath and promised to force the spring. Now I watch from far away, enjoying the show, but wondering too. Wondering what might have been, if only this good president had been a better man.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks presentation of All Too Human, A Political Education, written by George Stephanopoulos and read by the author. Produced and directed by Maya Thomas. Text abridged by John Whitman. Production coordinated by Daniel Metcalf. Tape edited, mixed, and mastered by Data Sound. All Too Human, A Political Education, is also available in hardcover from Little Brown and Company.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.